The visual arts are filled with figures and episodes from the Hebrew Bible. Why were artists and patrons, Jewish and Christian, so interested in the Hebrew Bible? What encouraged them to use it as a wellspring of artistic themes and visual imagery? Could the artistic legacy of the Hebrew Bible help us understand aspects of the Hebrew Bible more richly, more deeply? These episodes revolve around profound moments of fulfillment through transformation. Artists recognized the Hebrew Bible as a means through which they could expand the vocabulary and expression of their medium. They reveal fundamental truths about the covenants between God and man, about the challenges we face as divinely created beings in a fraught human world, and about the struggles and evil we face to ensure our liberty and survival. Such was and is the power of art. Welcome back to the Artistic Legacy of the Hebrew Bible. I'm Jacob Weiss. Having so far explored the artistic legacies of four narrative episodes from the Hebrew Bible, legacies we've really only barely skimmed, it's worth taking a step back and, looking at them together, trying to understand or make some general observations about what made them narratively appealing to artists or valuable for them. All four of the stories, The Binding of Isaac, Jacob wrestling with the angel, Moses with the Ten Commandments, and Esther before King Ahasuerus, are, to state the obvious, dramatic. They contend with life and death issues. In the case of Isaac, at the hands of his father Abraham, of Jacob, at the hands of the angel and his brother Esau, and of Esther and the Jews, at the hands of Ahasuerus and Haman, respectively. The threat they face is quite literally death. In the case of Moses, while it doesn't seem necessary to argue here for the drama of a story that revolves around the inception and unveiling of the fundamental moral code of human civilization, but here too, in addition to the inclusion of the prohibition against murder, the very definition of a life and death issue, the biblical sequence in which Moses descends from Mount Sinai to present the tablets of law to the people of Israel is the very stuff that art and eventually movies was made of. But perhaps even more revealing for our purposes, all four of these episodes revolve around profound moments of fulfillment through transformation. The test of Abraham, the confrontation of Jacob, Moses' transcendent bestowal, and Esther's brave enlistment are key pivot points, encounters within larger narratives through which the characters take on monumental challenges, emerging transformed to assume a new role and new responsibilities on behalf of their people. Many artists are naturally drawn to dynamic subjects, in part because they help animate and elevate the inherently inert character of their medium. Unlike music or literature, which play out and transmogrify sequentially, and which listeners and readers take in over extended spans of time, works of art remain, in effect, still, unmoving, unwavering. An overall impression of a work of art is made all at once, even if its details and subtleties only reveal themselves over time and through extended, close looking. It is upon the artist to generate a moving or powerful experience within this context. And so it's no coincidence that among the subjects that were popular among artists, especially of the Renaissance, Baroque, and early modern periods, when art was expected to impact and prompt an inner response in the viewer, were episodes that charted a dramatic, transformative experience, ones that were marked by a movement from point A to point B, with even the possibility of a few pit stops in between. More broadly, each of the episodes we've explored is consequential in the thematic and spiritual context of the Hebrew Bible. They reveal fundamental truths about the covenant between God and man, about the challenges we face as divinely created beings in a fraught human world, about the means through which we try to institute God's vision in society, and about the struggles and evil we face to ensure our liberty and survival. In this, the final episode in our series, we'll be exploring the artistic legacy of a singular figure, Jeremiah, the prophet who is associated more than any other character in the Hebrew Bible with the challenges of recognizing evil, of identifying its impact in the world, and of relentlessly enjoining others to staunch its flow towards the goal of establishing a better future. Given the circumstances of our present moment and the monumental difficulties many continue to demonstrate in recognizing evil and in distinguishing between the forces of good and evil in the world, the figure of Jeremiah may serve as something of a resonant and salutary one. As we'll see, artists took great interest in the image of Jeremiah, exploring the profound themes that resonate in the book, but also recognizing in the prophet's struggle a parallel one to that of producing great art. Jeremiah, the sixth book in the second section of the Hebrew Bible, focused on the prophets or Nevi'im, is initially set in the period of Josiah, king of Judah, who ruled for 3 decades in the second half of the 7th century before the Common Era. Josiah's reign was marked by a series of political and religious reforms, ones that, in the context of Jeremiah, are most significantly reflected around the character and locus of divine worship. The religious reforms instigated by King Josiah aimed not only at removing the worship of other gods, but also pushed the centralization of worship and religious authority around Jerusalem. Rural shrines and the spread of cultic practices were regarded as paths to paganism. Jerusalem was seen as the exclusive physical destination and spiritual antidote to these trends, as the passage from the book of Deuteronomy describes. The place that the Lord your God will choose of all your tribes to set his name there, to make it dwell, you shall seek and come there. Paganism was characterized not only as inherently troubling and heretical, but as a surefire track to national disaster and exile, punishment for the failure to honor the covenant with God. This is the context in which the book of Jeremiah is set, and it is the root of the prophet's central message. Jeremiah's main concern and the motivation for many of his laments is his contemporaries' wanton pursuit of strange gods, leading, as it inevitably will, to the devastation of the nation and the cleaving of its people from their homeland. While there is a hopeful, even upbeat message at the heart of Jeremiah's prophecies, he believed that God's commitment to the people of Israel is eternal, and that God would ultimately establish a new covenant with them. That is not the spirit governing most of his grief-filled words or most of the text of the book. The reader is aware from the very beginning, by the 3rd verse of chapter 1, in fact, which refers to Jerusalem going into exile, that Jeremiah's story will lead to the fall of Jerusalem to the Babylonians and to the destruction of the first temple in 586 before the Common Era. The book is most palpably marked by the dark clouds of political exile. The arc of events leading up to the Babylonian exile, the beginnings of the exile itself, and the exile's aftermath. Scholars generally divide the book into 2 major parts. Before the fall of Jerusalem, which we encounter in chapters 1 to 25, and the fall of Jerusalem and its aftermath in chapters 26 to 52. In some of Jeremiah's prophecies, he expresses the hope of a restored United Kingdom of Israel, that is, the Northern Kingdom of Israel reunited with the Southern Kingdom of Judah. But by the end of the 8th century, the Northern Kingdom had already been conquered by the Assyrian Empire, and by the very beginning of the 6th century, Jerusalem was being besieged by Babylonian forces. With dwindling remnants of the kingdoms under Jewish control, Jeremiah's hopes for political restoration come across as fantastical and are increasingly drowned out by his bitter denunciations and dire predictions. And so, what kinds of images did the prophet evoke? And how do they relate to the character of the book as a whole? Unlike the Hebrew biblical books upon which the previous episodes we've explored are based, the book of Jeremiah is a combination of prose and poetry, and it unfolds in no clear or linear chronological order. The interweaving of various genres, combined with the lack of chronological narrative, makes for difficult source material. The distinct character of this provenance is reflected in the freedom and malleability with which artists interpreted the text. On the one hand, there is a significant artistic tradition that focused on the image of Jeremiah lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem, though even here it is unclear to what degree artists used specific passages from the book as inspiration. Passages featuring Jeremiah's lament for the besieged or destroyed city can be found throughout, suggesting artists engaged here in representing not a specific passage, but a pastiche of text or the narrative impression generated by the book as a whole. On the other hand, there is an equally prodigious tradition that aims to capture the identity of Jeremiah based on his character as a prophet, unmoored from any one episode or event. In leaving behind specific textual points of reference, artists developed around the legacy of Jeremiah's image a parallel, but to some degree, completely independent visual tradition. The Hebrew biblical prophet was a key figure within the realm of church theological doctrine. As conveyors of God's messages and laws, as often harsh castigators of social and economic injustices or corrupt practices in Israelite society, and as foretellers of future redemption, Hebrew biblical prophets were called on to lay the foundations for Christianity. The words that came out of their mouths in the text of the Hebrew Bible were, and are, read and interpreted through a Christian lens, linked to events that are to come with the advent of Christianity. Thus, specific passages from the book of Isaiah, the book preceding Jeremiah in the section of the prophets, are frequently used as proof texts for Christian theological positions, like the concept of the virgin birth of Jesus, and the notion that the Messiah will be rejected and persecuted before being recognized as the path to redemption. By extension, Christian art, especially of the mid to late medieval era, when such typological reading became institutionalized, made frequent use of Hebrew biblical imagery and symbols. In this late 13th century altarpiece for a Florentine church, painted by the artist Cimabue, for instance, the heavenly throne on which Mary sits, holding the infant Jesus, and surrounded by a chorus of angels, is oriented in the register immediately above four Hebrew biblical figures, two of which are prophets, Jeremiah at the very left, Isaiah at the very right. The two figures at the center are Abraham at left, and David at right. Each of the four figures can be identified by the scrolls they hold, displaying biblical texts in Latin translation associated with each of them. According to Christian theology, they foretold or made possible the coming of Jesus. Jeremiah and Isaiah prophesied the coming of the Messiah via a virgin. and Abraham and David were believed to be direct ancestors of Mary and Jesus. David, who is given prominence in this particular gallery of Hebrew biblical figures, with his jeweled crown and bright red mantle, would have also suggested the royal lineage of those occupying the throne above. Isaiah and here Jeremiah both look upward towards Mary. Each holds up an open palm towards the viewer. The inclusion of these four figures below Mary's heavenly throne glorifies the prophetic heritage and priestly genealogy of Mary and her son, while also communicating the hierarchical relationship between Hebrew biblical and Christian biblical tradition. Just slightly later, a fresco panel by the great early 14th century Italian artist Giotto, painted for the Arena or Scrivani Chapel in Padua, represents the prophet Jeremiah in similar fashion. In his left hand, he holds a scroll, which, reflecting Giotto's new interest in strengthening the relationship between fictive and real space, illusionistically overlaps the round picture frame appearing to flutter into the observer's space. Like Cimabue's Jeremiah, his other hand is oriented palm out, facing the viewer. Bald-headed, with white tufts of hair at the sides, notable creases on his forehead, and a thick white-gray beard, Jeremiah is a mature figure engaging us with his important prophecy. For Christians, among the most resonant of them was his prophecy of a new covenant. "Look, days are coming, said the Lord, when I will seal with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah a new covenant. Not like the covenant I sealed with their fathers on the day I held their hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt as they broke my covenant, though I was a master to them, said the Lord. I have put my teachings in their midst, and on their heart I have inscribed it, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people." While Jewish tradition understands this as referring to a new covenant between God and Israel, one that will be fully absorbed or internalized, replacing the old covenant broken by Israel, the phrase new covenant came to be regularly used within the early Christian period as a designation for the Christian scriptures, that is, the New Testament. In this rereading, the new covenant would be understood to supersede the old Mosaic covenant, with the phrase, "on their heart I have inscribed it," said to refer to how Christian laws would be written on or embedded in people's hearts, rather than inscribed on stone tablets. In the context of churches and chapels, such images, bolstered by doctrinal sermons that drew on the New Testament, reframed Jeremiah's prophecies as allusions to an era of redemption through Christian worship and practice. One of the most interesting developments in the art on the exterior of churches during the late medieval era is the re-emergence of sculpture as an independent medium of religious expression. In the 11th and 12th centuries, while the papacy was in ascendance and built hundreds of pilgrimage churches to serve and educate its followers, ambitious programs of sculptural decoration were used on the facades and portals to engage and prepare pilgrims and worshipers before they entered the sanctuary. After centuries of relative obscurity making decorative work for religious institutions, sculptors began to conceive and craft figures and scenes in stone that increasingly distinguished themselves from their architectural backdrops. The image of Jeremiah was intimately intertwined with this development. For the Church of St. Peter at Moisins, a commune in southern France that served as one of the stops on a main pilgrimage route to the shrine of St. James the Major at Santiago de Compostela in northwestern Spain, The sculpted figure of Jeremiah literally serves as part of the foundation of the southern portal, a key point of entry to the church. The portal is divided vertically in half by a trumeau, the central pillar separating the two doorways from each other. On the front of the trumeau are three pairs of intertwined lions and lionesses, long-standing symbols of fierce and unyielding guardianship. On the west side of the trumeau, the left-hand side as one is facing the portal, is the figure of St. Paul the Apostle, the convert to Christianity whose letters on theology and ethics are incorporated into the New Testament. Facing Paul, on the door jamb at the very left of the portal, is the figure of Peter, namesake and patron saint of the church. Facing each other on the right-hand side of the portal are the Hebrew biblical prophets Jeremiah and Isaiah, Jeremiah at left and Isaiah at right as you face the doorway. The pairing of Hebrew biblical and New Testament figures was common during the Romanesque period as a means of suggesting the fulfillment of the law of Moses in the new Christian world, that is, the new covenant. Sculpted deeply into the east side of the trumeau is a striking representation of the prophet Jeremiah, whose elongated form extends almost 12 feet along the entire height of the pillar. While the marble figure, carved in medium to high relief, is still inextricably embedded into the narrow rectangular frame of the trumeau, Jeremiah adopts a dynamic pose and evokes a distinct character. With both hands, he clutches a scroll, which twists as it unfurls from his upper to his lower hand. Meanwhile, his body reveals a parallel pose, twisting in the same direction as the scroll, down through his legs and to his feet, his left leg overlapping his right. Jeremiah's beard again echoes this spiraling movement, with thick strands of hair curling down in waves that mirror the movement of his body. The figure's head inclines downward, Jeremiah's eyes cast in the direction of visitors as they enter or leave the church. The talented sculptor, who has not yet been identified, suggests that Jeremiah is communicating his message of prophecy directly to the worshipers. The twinning orientation of the body and the scroll strengthens the identification of Jeremiah with his message, the impression that the prophet is fully immersed in the act and calling of prophecy. It's worth considering how the prophet's character, or the way he is individually characterized in the book of Jeremiah, may have influenced the character of his representation. Of all the Hebrew biblical prophets, he is the one who conveys to the reader the most vivid sense of the person behind the words, not only because we know he is a priest from Anathoth, a town near Jerusalem, and his years of activity from the 620s until after the destruction of the kingdom of Judah in 586, but many episodes of his life are reported in narrative detail. We learn, for instance, that during the Babylonian siege of Jerusalem, while he was imprisoned in the house of King Zedekiah, Jeremiah was called on to redeem the property of his cousin Hanamel, essentially to purchase it so that it would not be lost to the family. In bailing out someone whom the text repeatedly refers to as the son of my uncle, Jeremiah reveals himself as someone who is swayed by and responsive to familial responsibilities. He has a sense of commitment to those close to him, his blood relations. But we also recognize that this apparently mundane economic transaction is directed by God. The word of the Lord reveals it to Jeremiah, or directs him to do it with the purpose of having the prophet take on the land as a symbolic act. The field, then, is not only a family plot in Anathoth that demonstrates Jeremiah's family loyalty and possible attachment to his hometown, but also represents and foretells the act of the people of Judah taking back and repossessing their lands after the impending destruction and exile. For Jeremiah, the act of prophecy is personal. The culture in which late medieval sculpture bloomed recognized the deeply personal character of Jeremiah's vision. A monumental sculptural project produced in northern France around 1400, one that we touched on in our earlier discussion of the image of Moses, reflects this idea. Produced as a burial monument for the Duke of Burgundy, Philip the Bold, by the Dutch sculptor Klaus Sluder, who worked as court sculptor for the Duke, the Well of Moses was originally known as the Great Cross, named for the tall cross that was designed to surmount the base of the well, though the cross itself no longer survives. The sculpture stood in the midst of a large cloister, part of a Carthusian monastery established by the Duke. The activities of the monastery, and specifically the devotional prayers of the Carthusian monks, were supported by Philip so that prayers could continuously be said for his soul. The Well of Moses was commissioned as part of the Duke's burial monument, intended not only to mark his resting place, but to serve as an engine, an intricately and masterfully carved stone engine, inspiring the monks towards prayer and expressing the hope for the elevation of the Duke's eternal soul. Defining each side of the hexagonal well are sculpted representations of six Hebrew biblical figures, each highly individualized. Moses, after whom the well was ultimately named, King David, and the prophets Zechariah, Isaiah, Daniel, and Jeremiah. Each figure is shown standing in front of a niche, and each is accompanied by an attribute or attributes that would have allowed them to be easily identified. Moses, for instance, holds the tablets of the law. King David wears a crown, and each of the prophets holds an unfurling scroll inscribed with passages of the book of that prophet. It's worth noting that in the case of Zechariah and Jeremiah, who is seen here, the prophets hold not only a scroll, which evokes the traditional form and historical origins of the Hebrew Bible, but also a book, suggesting the new era of Christian codices into which the text of both the Hebrew prophetic books and the New Testament were integrated. Further punctuating the living words of Jeremiah, the facial features of the sculpted prophet were based directly on those of Philip the Bold, represented here in a 16th century profile portrait that was copied after an original 15th century painting of the Duke. Wearing the contemporary garments of the Burgundian court and bedecked with a jeweled collar and brooches, this charmingly idiosyncratic and lifelike portrayal of the Duke reveals an era when not all court portraiture was idealized or, in the equivalent of our day, photoshopped. One can see from the long nose extended well over the philtrum towards the upper lip, the distinctively knobby chin, the prominent chipmunk-like cheeks, and the parabolically arched eyebrows, features closely shared by these painted and modeled faces, just how rigorously the sculptor Klaus Sluder used the Duke's appearance as the basis for his depiction of Jeremiah. From records, we know that Jeremiah in the Well of Moses originally wore a pair of spectacles, fashioned by a Flemish goldsmith, which must have lent the sculpted figure an even more individualized and bookish appearance. The glasses have long since disappeared, but in place, they would have surely strengthened the lifelike quality of the prophet and perhaps the figure's likeness to the Duke as well. Given the particular memorial function of the Well of Moses, it's striking that the Duke chose Jeremiah as the figure upon whom his features were modeled. Of the Hebrew biblical characters integrated into the monument, might one not expect King David to be the one with whom the Duke was fused, as it were? A founder of the Burgundian branch of the House of Valois, Philip collected a vast array of territories, insinuating himself as a peer and even a rival of the kings and kingdom of France. The divine providence of King David was used as a common aspirational symbol in other contexts of the Burgundian and French crown. But for Philip, it was not his mortal political legacy that he strove to secure through his patronage of Sluder in the Well of Moses, but rather his immortal spiritual one. In this context, Jeremiah represented incorruptible rejection of iniquity and steadfast pursuit of virtue, qualities with which the Duke hoped to be associated in death. The book of Jeremiah highlights the fragile and changeable nature of political power. The destruction and exile of the people of Israel and Judah are vivid demonstrations of that. What remains eternal are the moral values and religious ideals one strives to emulate, and according to which the redemption of Philip's soul would have been secured. In physical terms, Sluder's Well of Moses reflects the growing independence sculpture acquired at the end of the medieval and the beginning of the Renaissance eras. No longer embedded or locked into its architectural framework, as is still by and large the case in the Romanesque program at the Church of St. Peter we looked at previously, the carved figures of Jeremiah and his fellow Hebrew biblical characters emerge fully formed from their surroundings. Sluder deeply carved the figures in stone, stone that was quarried near the Burgundian capital of Dijon, not far from the monastery, decorating them with polychromy, essentially paint in different colors, and gilding. The sculpture conveys the impression of malleability, as if the figures wear tangible clothes, clutch flexible scrolls, and are covered in pliant skin. The strong sense of physical presence we get from Sluder's forms is complemented by their naturalism, noticeable as much in the highly personalized physiognomy of Jeremiah, or the Duke, as it is in the touching forms of six praying, grieving, and weeping angels who express the emotional toll of Philip's death and the devotional responsibilities of his followers. Within two decades of Sluder's monumental Well of Moses, another program for which the figure of Jeremiah was commissioned demonstrates the almost complete independence sculpture achieves in the early Renaissance. For the Campanile of Florence, the bell tower designed by Giotto that stands adjacent to the city's main cathedral, or the Duomo, the corporate body responsible for the maintenance and decoration of the building commissioned sculptures of 16 Hebrew biblical prophets to be situated on platforms along the facades of the tower. Nine of the sculptures were executed in the 14th century, while five were made in the 15th century by the Renaissance sculptors Donatello and Nanni di Banco. Among the five sculptures undertaken by Donatello is this over-life-size figure of the prophet Jeremiah, and he stands here over 6 feet 3 inches high. Originally placed on the north side of Giotto's bell tower, it was then moved to the second niche on the western facade of the cathedral. Since the work was to be seen by observers from 50 to 60 feet below, the sculptor was called on to generate a form that was legible, markedly legible, from a significant distance and from an acutely angled point of view. Inscribed on a scroll held in the prophet's left hand are the letters G-E-M-I-A, a shortened version of the prophet's name in Italian, identifying the subject. Although, from the figure's facial expression, physical demeanor, and overall character, there is no mistaking the prophet Donatello portrays. Jeremiah offered Donatello an inspirational subject. The prophet is depicted advanced in age, with raised veins on his hands and feet, and pockets of thin, loose flesh stretched below his chin and around his neck. But he's clearly also a man of determination and strength, the muscles of his arm and upper body, and his abruptly twisting pose, giving him a sense of powerful energy and movement. With the weight of the figure resting on his back leg to the left, yet his head turned in the opposite direction across his body and to the right, one has a sense that Jeremiah is discerningly considering the object of his gaze and ready to reveal his pronouncement at any moment. His deep-set eyes, edged with bags, crease-lined forehead, disheveled hair, light unkempt beard, and somber expression, do these suggest disappointment, anger, concern, sorrow, resoluteness? These features evoke less the content of the message that the prophet Jeremiah delivers, and more the ways Jeremiah's mission and frustrations as an unheeded prophet are imprinted on his persona. Donatello shifts the focus of Jeremiah's depiction to the impact that his trials as a prophet have on him. More than any other prophet in the Hebrew Bible, Jeremiah felt the burden of his calling. As was already mentioned, he was imprisoned by the king of Judah in the year before the destruction of Jerusalem. Since he was repeatedly prophesizing about impending destruction and exile in the midst of war with the Babylonians, Jeremiah could have been accused of sedition. Indeed, he seems to have been imprisoned more than once. In one episode, he's described as being cast into a deep cistern with muck at the bottom, left to die. According to his own account, priests from his hometown of Anathoth threatened to kill him. But even aside from the physical and administrative threats put to him, Jeremiah's dire predictions and somber assessments in a time of war made him far from popular, and he is constantly beset by anguish over his prophetic calling. In the face of unending frustration and personal torment, Jeremiah persevered with a mission he understood to be given to him by God. This combination in Jeremiah of determination and disappointment, of duty and unworthiness, distinguishes him in the context of the other Hebrew prophets and inspired Donatello to create a fully fleshed out portrait in sculptural form. Though the focus on Jeremiah's somber prophetic outlook and bitter personal struggles was developed in sculpture, it was in painting that the prophet's character received its purest expression. Still, it's revealing that the artist who created the painted image of Jeremiah that is now most closely aligned with the prophet considered himself first and foremost a sculptor, not a painter, and was inspired significantly more by three-dimensional sculptures than he was by two-dimensional paintings. Michelangelo, as we discussed in our episode on Moses and the Ten Commandments, was summoned to Rome by Pope Julius II to design and create his tomb. In the course of this commission, however, the artist was asked to take on another project, though you were never really asked to do something by the Pope. This project was the decoration in fresco of the ceiling and upper walls for the Sistine Chapel, a monumental task that took the artist over 4 years to complete and led to considerable disagreement between the artist and the patron over the nature of the work. In the end, a program was created, largely it seems under Michelangelo's influence, that drew heavily on subjects from the Hebrew Bible. Along the central spine of the ceiling, extending over 130 feet from the wall housing the Pope's altar to the chapel's entrance, the artist painted 9 scenes based on episodes from the book of Genesis, from God dividing light from darkness to the drunkenness of Noah. Tracing in sequential order a narrative that for Christians represents the fall of man or the entry of sin into the world, Michelangelo tells the story in groups of 3: the creation of heaven and earth, the creation of Adam and Eve, followed by the expulsion from the Garden of Eden, and finally, the story of Noah and the flood. Each of the main rectangular scenes is set within a fictive architectural frame, against which are represented figures of nude male youths called ignudi, a term meaning nude ones, coined by Michelangelo himself, perhaps to give these idealized classicizing forms a sort of art historical imprimatur. Bracketing each of these scenes from Genesis are pairs of Hebrew biblical prophets and classicizing sibyls, ancient seers who, according to tradition, foretold the coming of Jesus and Christianity. The pair depicted on either side of the first scene in the series, the separation of light from darkness, represents the prophet Jeremiah and the Libyan sibyl. Michelangelo's Jeremiah sits within an illusionistically painted stone niche, framed by columns and pilasters that bear the carved forms of chubby naked putti. Below is held aloft a cartouche that reads Hieremias, the Latin form of Jeremiah. And immediately behind and on either side of the prophet are two female figures, both turned to the left. The woman on Jeremiah's right side looks especially mournful and in distress. Though not conclusively identified, the figures have been plausibly identified as personifications of the lost kingdoms of Judah and Israel. Michelangelo here fully embraces the identification of Jeremiah with the act and attitude of lament. He sits hunched forward, his legs crossed over each other and positioned slightly back, while eyes downcast, he rests his head on and into his right hand, which seems to bear the head's full weight. The figure's right elbow rests on and pushes into the top of his right leg. Whether one regards Jeremiah's attitude as suggesting pensiveness or rejection, reflection or despair, or some combination of these qualities, it seems intended to evoke the way the prophet is characterized in the book of Jeremiah. As is vividly recounted in the biblical text, Jeremiah was brought low by his prophetic mission. It caused him unending personal torment. Whereas other prophets initially or intermittently express a sense of unworthiness for their calling, the stuttering Moses most famously, only Jeremiah continued to be beset by reluctance, unworthiness, and frustration throughout his career. Repeatedly, he expresses the wish to free himself from the burden of prophecy, but he cannot. He persists. God's will and the demands God places on him prevent him from breaking away, from relinquishing his calling. Jeremiah is all too aware of the misery and humiliation this will bring, but he is stuck. A vivid expression of this personal conflict appears in a poem uttered by Jeremiah in chapter 20. "You enticed me, O Lord, and I was enticed. You were stronger than I, and you prevailed. I became a laughingstock all day long, all of them mocking me. For whenever I spoke, I screamed. Outrage and violence I called. For the word of the Lord became to me disgrace and contempt all day long. And I thought, I will not recall him, nor will I speak any more in his name. But it was in my heart like burning fire shut up in my bones, and I could not hold it in." This sense of anguished frustration seems intimately bound up with Michelangelo's depiction of Jeremiah. From his worn features and hunched bearing, to his downcast stare and bent, gnarled limbs, this prophet seems disconsolate and thwarted. This impression is only enhanced, I might add, by seeing the figure from well below, which is how one is meant to see the ceiling frescoes. A striking detail of the painting is that Jeremiah's mouth, the primary and necessary tool of the prophet, is hidden, shielded behind the figure's right hand. Indeed, the position of the prophet's lower face, wedged into the palm of the hand, in an area between the index finger and thumb, conspicuously prevents any trace of his mouth from being seen by the viewer. This prophet seems unable to speak or be heard. Is Michelangelo here communicating the impact on Jeremiah of the recriminations and denunciations he received for his prophecies? Is he evoking the frustrations he suffered at repeatedly not having his prophecies and messages heeded? Is the artist echoing the theme of Jeremiah's poem, that the prophet cannot voice or act upon his desire to abandon his prophetic calling? However one characterizes the figure's demeanor or interprets what he is experiencing, it's clear that Michelangelo took direct inspiration from the Hebrew biblical text that vividly charts the prophet's inner conflicts and struggles. It's interesting to consider for a moment how much Michelangelo himself identified with Jeremiah, and how this very connection to the ancient Hebrew biblical prophet influenced his depiction on the Sistine ceiling. Here, I don't mean to suggest a kind of biographical identification. The genius artist, mistreated and misunderstood by his patrons and contemporaries, seeing a reflection of himself in the visionary prophet, rejected and diminished by his community. This is the stuff myths are made of, and such prosaic biographical reading of artists and works of art, which has influenced the way Michelangelo has been considered, perhaps more than any other artist, misrepresents both the inspiration of the creators and the depth of their creations. Rather, I think, there's a connection the artist recognized, or a point of resonance he saw, between core themes expressed through Jeremiah's struggle and the challenges undertaken by the artist in making art. Michelangelo, among other artists and thinkers of his era, conceived and helped institute a new idea of the artistic process. Running counter to the fundamental notion of an artist as one imbued with physical talent, talent that could be evaluated and compensated according to the act of making art, this new idea relocated the source of the artist's creative energy into their intellectual or conceptual faculties. Michelangelo understood the creation of meaningful art as being rooted in the artist's ability to see figures, forms, compositions, before they were actually executed in the sculpting or painting process. In essence, then, the most important tool for the artist was not their chisel or brush, but their mind. In some ways, this reimagining of the artistic process is what is at the root of our own modern concept of creative artistic genius. But for Michelangelo and his like-minded contemporaries, this idea did not simply have theoretical implications. It brought about fundamentally new challenges, ones that confronted artists in their ongoing work and perhaps especially in their negotiations with patrons and theological advisors. Some questions it raised. What is the artist to do when their creative drive disagrees with fundamental demands made by a patron or institution? If making art is driven by creative inspiration, what is the artist to do if that wellspring runs dry, that creative spark goes missing? How is the artist to navigate the fundamental break between the mental, inner source of their inspiration and the physical means through which their work is made? In the figure of Jeremiah, an endlessly frustrated and burdened, but committed and driven prophet, Michelangelo recognized a familiar and perhaps inspiring model. It is not surprising, then, that in the painted depiction of the prophet on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, many have recognized a self-portrait of the artist. Michelangelo saw in Jeremiah's struggle a mirror of his own struggles, not only with the Pope and papal advisors, but struggles that were part of his identity as an artist. And here, I'd like to suggest that the innovation that Michelangelo engineered in creating this frustrated and rather gloomy image of the prophet brooding on his arm perhaps was an inspiration for other images of artists who faced similar notions of creative frustration. This is an image, a print, an engraving made by the great 16th century German printmaker Albrecht Dürer, and it shows the figure of Melancholia, who is represented as a kind of personification of the artist, also with the tools of her trade left unused, but her mind, the intellect of this figure, left somehow still trying to find the means through which her intellectual capacity can be channeled into productivity. Jeremiah, I think, was the source for this very image and this new ideal of the artist. There is also a tradition that emerges of depicting the more specific scene of Jeremiah lamenting the destruction of Jerusalem, as we see here in Rembrandt's remarkable painting from 1630, painted just around the time he was about to leave from Leiden to Amsterdam, where he would spend the rest of his career. Here, despondent, his head in his hands, Jeremiah leans on a book labeled Bibel, or Bible, while a group of objects, lavish objects, seem to be left discarded at the side. Visible in the background is Jerusalem, the image of Jerusalem on fire, and clearly this represents the siege, the destruction of Jerusalem that Jeremiah had in fact predicted through his prophecies. Now, Rembrandt here relies not only on the book of Jeremiah and the text that inspired so many artists before him, but probably a text that had been written by Josephus, the Jewish Roman historian who, in the first century, prepared a kind of apocryphal version, a mythicized version of Jeremiah's life, including some of these lavish discarded objects. And I think here Rembrandt is musing on a theme that occupied him for much of his career, the contrast between the figure, a Hebrew biblical figure that is both taken by their calling and the idea of being engaged in the world. Jeremiah represented for Rembrandt in this painting a kind of tension between these two poles. Finally, I thought it would be interesting and worthwhile to end with this beautiful painting by Marc Chagall, the wonderful Jewish artist who depicted this image of Jeremiah in 1968. It includes a number of elements that we've seen from other depictions of the prophet. But in some sense, I think Chagall here is integrating two of the motifs that we've just drawn on. On the one hand, a prophet that is set within a larger landscape, a larger context, representing the story of the prophet, prophesizing and predicting the destruction of Jerusalem. And he sits here with his book, contemplating this book, possibly his book, possibly the Bible. At the same time, there's a sense that this prophet is not looking at the objects in his surroundings. He is not focusing on the angel. He is a figure like Michelangelo's Jeremiah, perhaps like Dürer's Melancholia, a figure who is engaged in the very notion of artistic struggle. And Chagall at this time was trying to integrate two what had been relatively disparate traditions. On the one hand, his Jewish tradition, the tradition from which he came, and the artistic tradition, which in some sense challenged many of these ideas. And in Jeremiah, he seems to be both fusing these two motifs, the narrative and the iconic tradition of Jeremiah, and the challenges that artists faced as depicting a biblical tradition that had such a rich history, and the ways that artists wanted to create a modern ideal for invention that used the Bible as a source material, but did not follow it slavishly. So I think this painting might serve for us in some way as a metaphor, both for the process through which we've seen the figure of Jeremiah interpreted and the very process of artistic interpretation of the Bible itself, something we've explored at stages over the course of this series. Artists did not simply illustrate the Bible, they reinterpreted it. And similarly, the Bible inspired artists to create art that, in fact, transformed their own medium. So these were two processes that very much were in contact with each other and that complemented each other. And what we see here in this painting, Chagall's own reflections of his own past and his own challenges as an artist, are very much expressed in the challenges that we've seen artists engage in across the sphere of biblical interpretation. So it seems like a good endpoint, although it leaves us with a lot more material to cover, and I hope that we'll have the chance on other opportunities to look at Hebrew biblical subjects again, because we've really only scratched the surface. Thank you so much for joining me for The Artistic Legacy of the Hebrew Bible.